This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, two members of California's 2011 Redistricting Commission discuss their experience redrawing the political lines in the state to better reflect the actual communities and interests that bind voters together. The Redistricting Commission was voted into law in 2008 through California's Proposition 11, the Voters First Act, and later in 2010, it was expanded to include U.S. congressional districts. After being selected at the end of 2010, the commission undertook a year-long comprehensive review process and extensive public feedback to build their district maps. After the adoption of the new map, California now has the most competitive districts in the nation, overturning a system where only one congressional seat changed party control in 255 elections. In 2018, Utahns narrowly voted in their own independent redistricting commission through Proposition 4. Unlike the Voters First Act, the Utah Commission would offer proposals to the state legislature to approve or reject. Since the proposition passed, negotiations between the legislatures and Better Boundaries, the organization that ran the proposition, have attempted to craft a replacement bill. In February, negotiations fell apart over the anti-gerrymandering language in the new law. A week later, a compromise was reached, and the anti-gerrymandering language was preserved, with an additional change that would allow the legislature to not vote on the commission's maps if they so choose. Today's panel explains the details of California's redistricting process and advises how Utah's commission can be most effective. On the panel are Commissioner Peter Yao and Commissioner Stan Forbes of the Independent Redistricting Commission for California. Also answering questions on the panel is Blake Moore, Republican co-chair of the Better Boundaries Initiative. This forum was recorded on November 14, 2019. Here's Commissioner Peter Yao.
Thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Peter Yao. Career-wise, I was an engineer, worked for a company that you may or may not have heard of before, Hughes Aircraft Company. That goes back a few years, but I retired from Raytheon Corporation. And I also have been involved locally at my city of Claremont. It's about 35 miles east of Los Angeles. I was on a city council and was their mayor for a couple of years. And I got involved with the Redistricting Commission in the 2008 timeframe. I don't know what your background is, but Californians got tired of the political situation in the state. The state wasn't getting anything done. Everything was gridlock. The parties were fighting back and forth, and the bond rating was the lowest in the whole country, and they just basically saying we got to make some changes. So in 2008, collect enough signature to put a ballot before the voters, and the voters approved it by 50.5% to 49.5% to establish a citizen redistricting commission, because they envisioned that what the cause of the problem is the fact that all the districts can be gerrymandered so badly that voters can't get them out of office even if they organize and try. And so the only way they can do it is do it outside of that, at that time, the political system. So when the commission was formed, 36,000 people applied to be on the commission. The state audit department was selected to pick 14 commission out of the 36,000 people. And through a year and a half of down selection, Stan and I both were picked at that point in time. And the commission's requirement is to mimic the diversity of California in every aspect, in income, obviously sex, ethnicity, help me, region, so that when people take a look at the commission, they can see themselves as part of the redistricting effort. At the end of the day, we were tasked to take the political factors out of the redistricting process. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or Democrat. We just want fair districts. And our mandate is to get the input from the residents of the state and try to draw the district the way they would want it if they were on the commission. So drawing fair districts was our task. So let me turn the mic over to Stan at this point, and he'll discuss more about what we did.
A little bit more about the origins of the commission. The legislative approval rate in 2008, when it was passed, was 8%. And after the commission, it was up to 60%. So that was a good thing. But the legislature had become completely unaccountable to the public. In the 765 elections we had in the decade preceding the creation of the commission, only 5 changed hands. So there was no functional democracy. I mean, in the year 2000, the legislature passed a map, and we refer to it as the Incumbent Protection Act, because it was designed to protect all the incumbents of both parties. So that's one reason why the public was, you know, fed up with the system, because it was completely unresponsive to the public. And the thrust of the commission really was to ensure that the public got what they wanted to have, not what the legislators wanted them to have. Our slogan that we came up with was that we think that the voters should pick their politicians rather than the politicians pick their voters. That's just a basic common thing. The other thing was, which was different from what you guys have, is that the commission had the final authority. When we drew the maps, that was it. The legislature had no authority and no opportunity to change the maps that we drew. So we actually had a lot of independent political power in that regard. Now, personally, my background is I went to USC in Los Angeles, and I have graduate degrees from UCLA in Russian and Japanese history, and I have a law degree from Vanderbilt, and I was a corporate litigator at one point in my life. And for what it's worth, my brother-in-law was a former dean of the law school here 25-odd years ago. And in fact, I saw his portrait last night. I left my law practice and became a farmer, because my family had started a farm in the Northern California in 1913. And my father got sick. It was a question to sell the family farm or take it over. And so I quit practice and came over and took the family farm. So I've been a farmer since 1979. I did live in Davis, California, where University of California is located. And I was on the city council there. I was president of the school board for 10 years. I was president of downtown. And what this tells you, I only offer that because what you'll see in the commissioners is that there's a real commitment to sort of civic engagement. All of us have some form of civic engagement. Like Peter, as he said, was on the city council and was mayor of Claremont. That's pretty typical of who we were. But the thing about the process was that there were some major components. In the picking of the commission by the auditor's office, they were looking for people who could be fair, could be nonpartisan, could put politics aside, and that was a major thing that we did. There are 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 4 independents on our commission. I'm an independent. The legislature really did believe we would fail, because they thought we would be riven by partisanship. But in fact, when you get 14 good government types together, you would have a hard time telling what party we were from, because that just wasn't our issue. Our issue was to deliver to the public what they wanted to do. Peter has a story. You want to tell the story about the guys who've been voting for 50 years?
There was, we traveled throughout the whole state. As I said before, we want to draw the draw district that people want. So obviously we have to talk to the people, okay? So been on the road for quite a few days. And one of the, this is toward the tail end of our tour. One of the speakers came up to a podium like this and start speaking to us. And he said, thank us for being there, which was fairly typical as an opening remark. And then he turned around and told us that he's been voting for 50 years. And he traveled a few miles to get to the site. But the next comment was the one that floored me. He said, in my 50 years, this is the first time government has come to me and asked me what I want. So at that instant in time, we knew we were doing the right thing in terms of satisfying our mission. We know, as I mentioned to you, the passage of the creation of this formation was just slightly over the minimum requirement. So if you look at that the other way, 50% of the people still didn't think that either we couldn't do the job or this was another way of gerrymandering the political process. But at the end of the day, we did our job. We created a set of maps that were more equal than any of the previous political redistricting. And across the state, people voted us as having the most transparent process, because the way we drew the map is in public. There was no backroom meetings. When we drew the map, it's projected on a wall, broadcast live, and it's archived for the people that couldn't get to that meeting. And when we talk about moving the line, we explained exactly how, why we're moving the line. And people were calling in to us saying that these are the outer changes you should consider, and we'll take that in lifetime. And at the end of it, after we drew the map, we wrote a paragraph to explain to people why we drew it the way we did. I mean, there are thousands of ways of drawing maps. And that's how we were able to convince them from the 50% at the minimum into believing that we are working on their behalf.
Yeah, there are three major principles that we applied to the process. First was transparency, as Peter talked about. Our entire application process is transparent. Everything that I wrote, all the my $2,000 loan to my son was on my application. And the finalists had a 90-minute interview. You can go watch that again if you want to, for all of us, because you can see the entire process of the selection process. Then in the transparency, everything we did was live, no secret meetings, everything was transcribed, everything was translated into 7 languages, and it was filmed live. And the public could contact us in real time and give us suggestions when we were having our map drawing. And we could make changes or not. But we would discuss what the proposal, so they could see that we actually were doing, we were taking what they had to tell us into account. And it was having an impact, or it wasn't, but at least they understood what we were doing. The second thing that was public participation. We had 34 public hearings across the state of California. We had 2,300 people come to the microphone and speak to us about what they wanted, what kind of a map they wanted. And we have all kinds of stories that we learned things that you could never know unless the public told you. 2 stories. And I could go on the rest of the afternoon, but I'm only going to tell you 2. Long Beach is the biggest port on the West Coast. And we thought, well, you know, our natural instinct was, well, we'll put the port in one district, and that'll be the thing that governs that district. But when the people come and testify to us, what they told us was that's not their concern. What their concern is are all the trucks that come up the 710 freeway from the port and all the diesel emissions and soot and stuff that affect their lives. So we wanted somebody who would represent them on that issue, not on the port. We would never have known that. Napa Valley, for all of you have heard of Napa Valley, we understood when we drew a draft district of the wine growers. Fine, but they came and testified to us and said, as far as you went, that's fine. But what you don't understand is that the warehousing of the wine is an integral part to growing wine. And so we redrew the lines to include the warehouses in the district. We would never have known that if they hadn't come and told us. And there's a whole bunch of stories like that where the public basically told us things that we would not have known, so we could draw a district that was representative. The last thing was accountability. as Peter alluded, at the end of the process, we had to justify every map that the law had required. There were 6 criteria in the law, and we had to explain how that district met all those criteria. You might not agree with the map I would draw, but at least you understand why I do it that way, because as Peter said, there's a lot of ways to draw maps that are all fair. One other thing is that we did not look at any political data at all. We did not look at registration. We didn't look at where the incumbents lived. We didn't look at the existing maps. We also rotated the chair of the commission meeting by meeting between parties, so you didn't get the observation that the meeting was being run by one party or another. So we went out of our way to look nonpartisan. Now, competition was not one of the criteria, but by creating fair maps, California now is considered the most competitive state in the country, and at least 7 districts, congressional districts, are in fact competitive, and maybe as many as 10. No other state has that kind of competition. The virtue of competition is, if it's competitive, the voters can change who represents them. So there's accountability at the congressional level. If we don't like what you're doing, we're going to vote you out of office. And the map is drawn in such a way that by being fair, doesn't have to be partisan, that we can do that. And so that makes people much more responsive, because when you can't vote somebody out of office, they don't care about you anymore. They don't listen to you anymore. You can't even get a meeting with them. And so the ability to provide accountability was a very important factor in what we did.
That was Commissioner Stan Forbes of the Independent Redistricting Commission for California. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, 2 members of California's Redistricting Commission explain how they developed a new political map through multipartisan review and extensive public comment. First, Blake Moore, Republican co-chair of the Better Boundaries Initiative, explains Utah's redistricting commission structure and process.
So before we jump to questions, hopefully what they've already presented will pique your interest quite a bit. I've had a chance to hear it a couple times, and it gives me an enormous amount of excitement and hope of what's to come for Utah. But I'll briefly give kind of an overview of where we're at in the state right now in Utah, and then we'll open it up for questions. And if there's something specific to our process or our structure, I'll be able to chime in as well. But as brief introduction, my name's Blake Moore. I'm a U grad myself, back from 05. You heard UCLA and USC mentioned. We don't like that very much around here. With UCLA, we need a big win this weekend. So, I'm a co-chair of the Prop 4 campaign. So Better Boundaries, Proposition 4, those are synonymous. And I've been involved in the process since pre-signature gathering, since we were in the design phase of what this would look like. So from our entire group, we're extremely appreciative for them to come and spend a couple days. And we've talked to all sorts of people. They were on Doug Wright yesterday, and just sort of establishing what it is, what they've been through, and there's going to be a lot of similarities to draw. So in Utah, we had the benefit of the process that they've gone through and several other states, to see what it is, how they've set it up for their states. And Utah took a very specific to our demographic and what we want to do. And so I'll give you a little bit of those details. But just briefly to highlight, why I got involved. Graduated from the U back in 05. I worked for the federal government for several years. And got back, was working, came back working here. I was finishing my master's in public policy. And I wrote a paper. And they were asked that we got to choose any topic area, any political issue type of thing that we got to choose from. And I don't know if you've seen much of the polling that goes on in the state, but I've seen a poll recently within the last year that had 12 issues from healthcare to air quality, education, and listed out 12 total things. Do you want to know what was 12th of 12? Redistricting. But I am here to literally say that redistricting, none of that other stuff can even matter unless we can really properly govern, stand up fair government processes to then we can have elected officials that are accountable to the general public and those other issues can get tackled. So it's kind of funny. Redistricting is not that known. It's pretty unclear on how it actually works. It's not this big buzzword that everybody understands and wants to talk about. But I decided to write a paper on gerrymandering back in my public policy class. 2 days after I finished and submitted my paper, I texted a good friend of mine. I'm a Republican co-chair. I know him to be a Democrat. And I said, hey, we should really think about putting together some type of independent redistricting commission. He texted me the next morning with a link to a Better Boundaries had just formed, and he had texted me a link to utahpolicy.com. And I immediately went down to Dan Jones's office because I worked with him and asked him, can you please, I've never asked you for anything. I took your class, 70 years ago. Can you please get me in touch with these folks? Within a week, I had breakfast with them, and they asked me to be a co-chair. And it's been one of the greatest experiences to be able to go through this whole process. It's been frustrating at times, but to see where we've come and to where we are now is a really, really great thing. So theirs was, I would consider, a landslide victory back in 2008 when they won by 50.5, correct? We won by 50.3. So a much, much tighter race than what they were able to experience. It was a tight race, but we are the law of the land, and what exists right now and the way that it is set up is for there to be a 7-member commission. So it's slightly different from this, but again, we took 18 other versions of this across the country. There was 5 that were up for election in 2018. So if you look at that, half the country has decided, okay, 200 years of this gerrymandering process and the fact that both parties do it, like that's not good enough anymore. We need to set up good governance, good processes in our government so we can get better results after these types of things are established. So we've had a chance to, it's a 7-member commission, and they'll be made up of both parties. There'll be unaffiliated voters associated with that as well. And then the governor will appoint a chair as the 7th person. Any maps that they decide and draw will need a 5 out of 7 supermajority vote. So no one party people within that can steamroll it or anything like that. So there's a supermajority element to it. And so it establishes a commission, and then it also establishes several standards that are associated with it. You know the one standard that all districts, whether state level or federal level, they have to have equal population. So it's one person, one vote. We incorporated into the 2008 election several more things like communities of interest should stick together. Where possible, counties and municipalities shouldn't be arbitrarily cut up for partisan gain. Can't use political data. You don't get a chance to just look to see where all the parties cluster in the certain areas and then draw maps associated with that, or incumbent addresses, things like that. So there'll be a 7-member group that are made up of non-political or non-lobbyist, non-current or potentially in the near future politicians or elected officials. It'll be a group of folks that care about the community, that are interested in this, and they're willing to spend some time to draw the maps. There's one big difference from the California to ours, and theirs is a binding commission, ours is a non-binding commission. The commission will draw maps, submit them to the legislature. The legislature then has a chance to vote up or down on it. At that point, there'll be a process that goes through. If they choose to vote down on it, then they have to defend why they drew different maps, and hopefully bringing out a very, very transparent process. So that's a very, very quick overview. If there's questions, some of the specifics of that, I'm happy to address that. But overall, where we're at now was a year ago that we had the election, and the census will take place in 2020, at which point the commission would then convene in 2021, and we would draw new school board, state legislative, so House and Senate districts, as well as congressional districts. So hopefully there's some questions that have been piqued from this, and if there's anything particular to Utah, I would love to be able to answer. And again, thank you for being here, and especially to our commissioners. So,
I have two questions. The first is, what are you compensated for your participation? or what is the motive for people to want to be on the commission? And the second question is, do you have the breadth that the Utah Commission has as far as the types of districts, or are you focused just on congressional and Senate districts?
We are responsible for all the legislative districts and the congressional districts. So we have 53 congressional districts and 120 state legislative districts. We're responsible for all of those. With regard to the other, yes, we're compensated. In fact, one of the, I think, good things about the law is that you don't want this to be a rich man's game. So what they did, the normal commissioner in California for any commission gets $100 a day. We get $300 a day, although we're doing this for free because this is, we're here as well, a number of, we've gone to like a dozen other states because we won a $100,000 grant from Harvard to go out of, we were in a competition. There were 500 programs that were competing and we won, and we got $100,000 to fly around the country to basically do the same thing, talk to legislators, anyone who's interested in what we did. So yes, we are compensated, but that's not the reason we did this. We did this because we believe in it. We think the government should be accountable, that they should be responsible to the public. And we are all small D Democrats, absolutely. And we just, so, and all of us, if he goes on the commission, are also civic types. And
Stan,
so we
correct
were,
me if I'm wrong, but the timing was about a 6-month process that you were all working pretty full time.
That's right. We were, the first time we sat as an entire commission was January 1st, 2011. The maps had to be done to meet the timeline for the 2012 election by July 31st, 2011. So we had 7 months to create state agency, do all the data, do all the interviews, and draw the maps. And we did.
Would you repeat the second part, the second question?
The legislative districts. He was able to answer it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They actually told me a story of, and people gave up their day jobs to come onto this for 6 months. There was a consultant that was in Silicon Valley. She gave up all of her clients to spend those 6 months. They joked that it took her a little while to get some of that clientele back, but they dug in and went full time on it. So
when the opportunity was advertised, it was generally advertised as a quarter time activity. So all of us felt that 10, 12 hours a week is not a big deal. But when it comes down to it, you do what's necessary to make this happen. And we've often been thanked for our effort, but the reward that we receive, being able to improve democracy, being able to kill the gerrymandering process after it's been in California for 275 years. When I say killed it, gerrymandering does not exist in California anymore. There's no such thing as a gerrymander map, okay, throughout the whole state system. In fact, that independent redistricting, it's flowing down to counties and cities, okay, even though it's not part of the original effort. When people see how well this works, they want it. So the effort, yes, there were sacrifices. A lady with four kids, all below 10 years old, she made it to the meeting every time. Usually the meeting is in Sacramento. She lives about 50 miles away. Meetings will usually end late, 8, 9, 10 o'clock. She drives home, tuck the kids in. Start in the morning, 8 o'clock, she'll drive another 50 miles to be at the meeting. So the rest of us, like Stan and I, are retired. Our time is our own. But there were small businesses, people that didn't anticipate having to essentially work the effort full-time for a number of months. And they definitely suffer financial impact and otherwise. But I can speak for all 14 of us. We wouldn't have done it any other way.
It's just a max privilege. One thing I want to say, the makeup, we were asked about the makeup a little bit. There were 14 of us. We had 8 men, 6 women. We had 7 from Northern California, 7 from Southern. We had 3 Anglos, 4 Asians, including South Asia, and 4 Latinos, 2 African Americans, 1 Native American. Our income ranged from someone who made $35,000 a year to well over $250,000 a year. So we really were a microcosm of the entire state.
Commissioners, thanks for coming.
You may have answered this already, but how has the political balance changed, if at all, since you redrew the maps?
We started with a clean slate. That was a commission decision. At the time that we started, there were some so-called problem districts because of the Voting Rights Act, 1963. It was the Section 3 in particular, right?
Section 5.
Okay, I always got the. These districts had violated the Civil Rights Act in the past and before, and every district they draw since has to go to Washington, D.C. to get approval, okay? So, and we don't understand the Washington, D.C. process, so we were real conservative with these districts, so we decided to start with those districts to make the minimum change so that we don't get all the maps wiped out because Washington, D.C. disapproved of how we changed the district. And from that point on, we start either rotate to the right, rotate to the left, get the right numbers, and try to meet all the demand that people ask of us to do. And that's basically how we... We didn't even look at how the previous districts were done, because that's unimportant to us. We basically, with a clean slate, draw the map that the people want. If it's similar, if it's identical, it's strictly by accident. The intent of drawing the map is totally different. Previously, it's for political purposes. In our case, what do you want? Tell us, and we'll make it happen, or try to make it happen. Does that?
Let me ask a little bit more about it. Is that in California? I mean, California is a super majority Democratic state. It just is. And indeed, in 2018, the Republicans lost 7 House seats, but they were so close it took a week to count the votes. And so that's why I say there are at least 7 seats that could flip back, and maybe as many as 10. So we're the most competitive state in the country right now. And I mean, I've been asked at the Rotary meetings, sort of like, well, how hasn't this been a Democratic power grab? And I said, no. The problem in California is that the people of California simply don't support what the Republican Party of California does. That's just the reality. And when that happens, that's guess who wins elections. And that means, so if the policies change, or if the political environment changes, the Republicans have every opportunity to come back and being a meaningful force in California.
Hi, thanks so much for being here. I have 2 questions. One, when you say that like gerrymandering doesn't exist anymore, or like certain counties look different ways, how do you measure that? And then also, when you take like the kind of anecdotal data from like the I don't know the word, the places where you'd come and talk to voters, how do you quantify that into like a specific line drawn on a map?
Well, let me go to the second one first. Our districts are very large. Our assembly districts are 465,000 people. Our Senate districts are 930,000 people, and our congressional districts like yours are about 703,000. You will clearly hear competing interests, and we heard that. And you individually make value judgments. For example, I'm the most northern person. I'm the only farmer on the commission. It would be possible to draw legislative districts in California based on Sacramento, which is the big population center in Northern California, and run them north as wedges, and there'd be no real representation at all. But we didn't let that happen. We thought we needed to have some, I'll call them pure districts, that will really are representative of rural or mountain California. And we did that with just a value system that we had. We had a tendency to protect or people of lesser means. I'll give you 2 examples. We paid attention to where the farm workers lived, because we recognized that they, by their culture, by their economic status, would not really be able to participate and had no history of participating in the political process. So we want to be sure that they had an ability to be set up to participate in the political process. There's an area in Oakland or in the Oakland Hills versus Richmond. Richmond is a working class area. Oakland Hills are not a working class area. It's very upper class. And so we could have drawn a district that would have allowed the hills to predominate or allow the flats to predominate. We chose to let the flats predominate, again, because we considered that the working class in any just doesn't have the same level of political engagement that the upper or wealthier classes have. So we wanted to be sure that they had a better chance to participate and have meaningful representation. And you make judgments like that. I mean, in Southern California, we made those kind of changes. We had an opportunity, that's probably a poor choice of words, in Los Angeles to reduce the number of African-American districts at each level by one, and been completely consistent with the Voting Rights Act. But we actually had Congresswoman Waters come and speak to us, and the comment was made, I don't need to have a black district because I have a coalition district, and I don't need to have overweighted African-American district. So we, and this was a big policy debate within the commission, we chose to not give an overweighted district to her because that would have reduced African-American political power in California. And that we just showed we weren't going to do that. That just was a value judgment. And so your commission is going to make value judgments, but we have to make it clear that we're making them. And we're not going to hide it behind something else. We're going to tell you why we did it. And you can agree with me or not agree with me, and you can get the microphone and argue with me. But at least you're going to know why I did it. And so that's how we dealt with that. What was the first question?
Just like how you measure whether or not...
Oh, it's a value judgment issue. It's just a value judgment.
Thank you.
That was Commissioner Stan Forbes of the Independent Redistricting Commission for California. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back.
So you had mentioned that each district has the same amount of people. So how do you count that? What about undocumented people and children? Does that count, or is it only voting age people? And if, I guess the follow-up question is, do you agree with the way it is now, or should it change?
The second part of your question is easy to answer. We don't have anything to do with who qualifies and who doesn't qualify. The requirement in 2010 was every person is counted, okay? Whether it's legal or illegal, that's the law. And it's not our responsibility to say that this shouldn't be and so on. Now, there had been problems. For example, many prisons in California built in a cheap land away from the city centers and so on. And so with a large prison, as you all know, prisoners can't vote. They lost that privilege. So what it means is the residents in that district probably have up to twice the voting power that the rest of us have, okay? The census organization is well aware of that inequity, but we have to work to the law, and that's the way it is. And they tried to get us to help them to address that problem, and we couldn't do it because of budget issues and so on. But so that's the requirement. And I'm sorry, I forgot the other part that you asked, of the question that you asked.
Like, so you count children too? It's not like,
yes,
it's not like the voting,
yes,
age?
The census is used for many other reasons in addition to the voting. Okay, so the census department is responsible for coming up with an accurate count. And then we use the census number to divide up the district to the same size. Okay, now there's a question on the variance. In the federal districts, the congressional districts has to be plus or one heads, okay, among all the districts. That's the tightest. But in the state districts, the state is silent on that topic. Now we can easily do it to plus one, minus one head, but then we would have lost the opportunity to not to divide up cities, not to divide up the neighborhoods, and so on. So we end up setting that, our own internal requirement, to plus minus 0.5%. And we feel that the Supreme Court would support us on that kind of variance. And when the data came out, we actually did plus or minus 0.25%.
There was one interesting issue that we did have to deal with. It was the confluence of the Voting Rights Act and the number of people in the district. California, as is no secret, has a significant number of illegal aliens in it. And we were required, however, to create, under the Voting Rights Act Section 2, to create as many, I'll call them Latino districts, give them an opportunity, the language was something like give them an opportunity to elect a person of their choice. Practically speaking, that means you have to have at least 50% of the voters in that district have to be Latino. But if you go just by ethnicity, if you put 50% in the district, you wouldn't have 50% who could vote because there's a big chunk of them who are not allowed to vote. So we had to figure out a way, and we basically added 2 or 3% to the number of people of Latinos in the district, so there would be enough Latinos that they could elect someone. Otherwise, we would have been sued by MALDEF and other such political action groups that are Latino-based, because, in fact, we, on paper, half the people are Latino, but not half the voters are Latino. And so we had to sort of adjust the number of Latinos in the district to be sure that there were enough of who could vote. And again, we don't have citizenship data. Not getting into that issue. We just did a raw count. So we had to make an adjustment to the number of Latinos in the district so they would have a chance to actually elect the person of their choice. I like old white guys with beards.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, thanks again. Very interesting, and I really appreciate you sharing your insights across the country. I think that's fantastic, and I think this is the kind of thing that's good for democracy, so I applaud it. Specifically, what I'm curious about is your insights relative to the governance of the body, and specifically the point of you have the authority to set the boundaries versus being more advisory to a political body, a legislature, and so forth. So, you know, what's your reaction to that? And then more specifically, I guess the question I would ask is, if you were in that hypothetical and you had to advise a political body, would it have changed your approach? Would there have been political calculus that would have crept in? I realize it's hypothetical. So, answer to either way.
Hypothetical, but a question I'm very interested in hearing the answer to. It's a great question.
I think in the group you had, because of our very nature, we would have been as apolitical as we were. I don't think that would have changed at all. A question that's somewhat along those lines, though, I want to, because I've been asked this question, and you hear it. Well, gee, you guys are unelected. Shouldn't our elected representatives be the ones who get to make this decision? And my counter argument is, that's the false choice. The choice here is not between electeds and unelecteds, because if electeds have created districts where they can never lose, there's no accountability. So your real choice is between those who have a vested interest and those who don't. And I think you get fairer maps if you have those who don't have an interest get to draw the maps.
That kind of flows into my question. And this might be, I think, starts as a question for you, like, and then might pivot. So last fall, we passed 3 ballot measures in this state. The legislature took on two of them to alter. Is there a concern that the legislature will either try to undermine the ballot measure that was passed? And if not, is there a concern, since the maps are not binding, that they will do so in the future? And then pivoting to the commissioners, what did your state legislature do when this initiative was initially passed in California? Was there pushback from those who would ostensibly lose power, or did they welcome it?
So are you suggesting that they would not respect the will of the people in this particular instance?
I would never suggest such a thing.
Winning the election, we became the law of the land. Absolutely. It's always going to be an issue. We've seen it in Prop 2 and Prop 3. Prop 4 doesn't take place, really doesn't go into effect until 2021, until after the census. So we're very vigilant in this. And we've made, every effort to make sure the public understands what our initiative is,
that the legislators understand what our initiative is, and that we're willing to discuss this and talk about this ad nauseum and help everybody understand what we're trying to accomplish here. So yes, it's obviously a concern, and it's something that we're very engaged in making sure that the will of the people is going to be protected. So.
Let me add to that is, if you want us to make any kind of recommendation, I would make sure that the default option is not more attractive than the map that this commission is going to be drawing. In other words, don't give incentive to anyone on the commission to throw in the towel, okay? Now, from our perspective, since we were tasked with drawing fair maps, when the question came up at one of these events, somebody asked us, so if you were not able to reach consensus on the map, what would happen? We kind of look at each other, and we really haven't thought about that issue for a long time, because over our dead body, are we going to let somebody else draw the maps that we've been trying to work a whole year to draw? It just wasn't going to happen. So I think there's a strong motivation if you give the independent commission authority to come up with the final product, and not even a governor or anybody can veto it or change it. Now, they can change it, but they have to go through the court of law. In other words, in California, if they don't like it, whether it's a citizen or whether it's a senator or a congressperson, they basically have to challenge the map through the Supreme Court. And we had three challengers, and we won unanimously on all three of them with unanimous justice supporting us. So they basically interpret that the maps are fair because they can go back to any one meeting, any single meeting. Oh, the business guy that I pass out, there's a little red link on it. That's our website. If you go to the website, anything that's you interested in that eight-month period that we did to join, it's still on the map, okay? If you want to look at our interviews, it's still on the map. So
8 months of map drawing online, invigorating. I'm sure you're all going to go right to
now
it.
You asked about pushback. Let's say we were not the most popular people in the state of California for politicians. They all hoped and expected that we would fail. And to give you an idea, our initiative passed in 2008. In 2010, there were two more initiatives put on the ballot. One of them was to give us the authority over drawing the congressional seats. The other was put on there by Nancy Pelosi to get rid of us. We won big, they lost big. I will tell you, we don't have a lot of friends in the legislature, but there's nothing they can do about it because we have the final authority. And the public likes us. So I think they've come to live with us, but that doesn't mean they're going to love us.
Another thing is, after the maps were released, there was a challenge directly by the legislators to the court to void all the maps, okay? And the Supreme Court, that's one of the decisions, Supreme Court saying our maps are good. And the justices on the Supreme Court were 6 out of 7 justices were Republican appointees, okay? When the state is a blue state, okay? And they basically join in saying these are fair maps. There's absolutely no merit to the challenge. So it doesn't stop after the maps are drawn. The reason we're on the commission for 10 years between census count is, if the maps are challenged with another new lawsuit, you think the legislators themselves will protect the maps that are drawn? We have to be in place to make sure that we can put up a fight to keep the map there.
You talk about the diversity of the council and the different data points you looked at to districts. So feedback from the constituents, race, income. What other data points did you have on your constituents, and what was the source of that data? So did you look beyond race and income? Did you have access to education levels? What other data did you have, and where did it come from?
We did not use any other data except what the people told us and what the raw numbers. And the reason for that is, again, this was not for us to take data and come up with an opinion of what it ought to be. This is for them to tell us what they wanted. And that was important. So we didn't use any other data.
But you're speaking specifically to the makeup of the commission.
I'm speaking
to the makeup of the maps, right?
Makeup of the maps, because you talked about X percent Latino or X percent of income. How do you know that? What's the source for that? And did you look at more than just race and income?
No, in fact, we didn't look at income either. We just looked at, our income thing was sort of a general knowledge that the area of Richmond, California is a working class neighborhood. We didn't have any more specific than that.
How did you get
anecdotal.
The communication out so folks could come and tell you what is, because what you're saying here is we didn't use any partisan data, and we limited the amount of demographic other than census information. And then when folks came and told us certain things, it's sometimes tough to get the public to engage in certain things. How did you get them to come to your meetings? Because it sounds like they were quite well attended.
I started out by saying that the measure barely passed, okay? And 50% of the people still didn't trust the commission even after we won. So that we knew that along the way, besides drawing what we consider to be fair maps, we have to convince the people that we're really doing the work for them. One of the decisions we made is to all the commission, all 14 of us, attend every meeting, no matter whether it's in Southern California or Northern California, whereas the quote unquote more efficient way of doing it is if you live in Northern California, you take care of the Northern region, and likewise for the Southern California. We want to make our presence, we want to basically stay in front of the people so they can watch us work, so they can see how we work as a team, how we communicate with each other to convince them that we are really doing the work on your behalf. And that message can be done just by simply telling them that's what we intend to do. They have to be convinced of it. By having 14 of us going to each of the events, automatically the local media will pick it up, okay? And automatically it'll be a big, especially when we go into the smaller town, it'll be the biggest event for that night. And every meeting that we have on the public outreach, the conference room is never big enough. There are more people that want to come up and address us. So getting the word out, doing it the way we did it, was never a problem.
I mean, to give an idea of what Peter said, I myself did more than 80 interviews on NPR, on interviews with editors of papers, of anybody, went Rotary clubs, and we all did the same thing. So we were all out there a lot. The other thing is that a number of the groups, NAACP, University Women's, a number of groups like that, made sure that their people knew that this was going on and to come. Also, lastly, we also scheduled our public hearings when people could come. We did not have them 9 to 5. We had them at 6 o'clock and would run off on to 11 or 12. We would have them on Saturdays. We would have them in times that were convenient to the people, not convenient to us. So they would have an opportunity to come. And I think that made a big difference.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could tell us about voter participation before and after the redistricting.
We did track that before, and there actually, unfortunately, I will tell you, there has not been a significant increase in some, but not meaningful, and certainly not that we can attribute to us. We'd hope to see that, and other states have seen it, but we have not.
I think that is just about all the time we have, so if you all want to take a moment to wrap up, you have a couple minutes.
Thanks for inviting us here, and it really is very meaningful for us to have the ability to spread the word to the other states. My personal hope is that all the states will adapt this fair redistricting activity. Now, some state will move faster than the other states. Don't let that discourage you. And every state has to do it their own way. We're here not trying to sell the California model to you, but we wanted to let you know that it has worked well for us. And California is probably one of the most complex and difficult states. The county I live in has 24 million people. The state has 40 million people. So you can see how one county, you know, dominates a lot of activity. But that's how different the California is. I wish you the best of the not only luck, but progress in your venture.
I tell each set of legislators I speak to, because I've testified in at least a dozen states, and I start out and by saying, remember, these seats don't belong to you. They belong to the public. And don't forget that. Now, that puts the responsibility on you to let them know that these seats belong to you, and you have to tell them what you want to have them do, and because you're the ones who have to hold them accountable, and this process gives you that opportunity.
I got into this as I was writing that paper that I mentioned. Again, papers matter. You're in school right now. It was a great lesson for me to learn that it can lead to something that I've been involved with for the following 3 years. It was the late Senator Bob Bennett, who I have a lot of respect for, Republican senator from our state. And he was the one that made the comment about, you know, how disappointed he was to see such egregious gerrymandering take place in our state. To see the progress we made, we still have a long road to go to declare victory. But the fact that we're here talking about what the commission is going to do instead of, can we get enough votes? Can we get enough signatures to get on the ballot? Can we win this election? We're talking today and moving this towards 2021 of actually implementing this, where a group of 7 citizens are going to go and draw the maps without any sort of personal gain or political gain or partisan gain that's going to take place. And it will create a really, really positive outcome for the state. And we're really looking forward to working with folks like you that are interested in moving this towards the next couple of years. So thank you so much. We really appreciate the commissioners for coming in. Appreciate you being here.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.